might as well go ahead and start here. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Yeah, probably be a little bit light turnout. January seems to do that sometimes, but we'll let other people come in as they manage to make it. I do want to explain a little bit. I'm actually going to be leading most of this today. One of the things that I wanted to be able to do during this year, since we're kind of sharing and both learning doing things, is to lead a longer program. So Leslie's here. She's going to come up here and join me when we get into question and answers to give you a little bit more perspective on things. But I'm going to kind of be using this program for some of my own learnings. So we've moved into ethics. Leslie, last time worked with you on right speech. Before we move into right action, are there any outstanding questions that you feel you didn't get answered or need to be addressed? I know all of you have had a chance to meet with your mentors, and hopefully you were able to answer most of your questions in that there. Okay, well then let's go ahead and settle down and do meditation and settle into the day, and then after that we'll go on into right action. So, just kind of find yourself a position, an attentive position, where you can be aware of the process of settling into your meditation. Notice any intentions you have, intentions to let go of the outside world, to focus on this moment here and now, and just start quieting your mind, quieting your body, settling into that. So turn inward and take a note of how your mental and physical state right now is conditioning you. Notice your mood, your mental state, your body. Reflect on the origin of those experiences. Where are they coming from? Are they the product of just the last couple of moments walking in here? They arise earlier in the day? As your mind states become clear, just acknowledge them. Let them go. Don't push them away. Just release them to be on their own while you do other things. If it feels that's too difficult and they don't want to go, just acknowledge that and don't fight with them. Are there ways you can be kind to yourself right now? Notice what's arising in your breath. Notice what's arising in your body. If you're talking to yourself, then extend your kind intentions toward that speech as well. Allow yourself to notice any wise or unwise action that's arising in your mind. Are you aversive? Are you kind and non-harming? And just sit with that. Quietly sitting with what's arising as a form of right action, especially if you can be kind to it and just let go, or just be aware and acknowledge. All of those are a form of right action. So we're just going to let you sit quietly now and relax into the moment. Thank you. Nice way to start being here. Last time you transitioned with Right Speech into the Ethics section, one of the three sections of the Eightfold Path, the first being the Wisdom section, this one being Ethics, the next one being Mind Training, and this being the fourth element of the path, it puts us about halfway through. I always found it somewhat difficult to get my head around the ethics part of this, not because the ethics is hard to understand, but in some ways it seemed almost too simple. If you read what goes on in right action, the Buddha himself basically doesn't describe it in too many places, but when he does, he said, "And what, monks, is right action? Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct. That, monks, is called right action." It seems in many ways that it is not a really deep subject to go into. And I also think in the West it's something that has been understated. I think historical reasons for that, when people in the West, well, at least when I started practicing meditation a number of years ago, were really much more interested in the meditation practices, the concentration practices, those types of esoteric things. And so the ethics, when it was taught, was kind of glossed over. And the other problem with it is that it sounds too much like some of the stuff that we're used to, you know. It sounds like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. And so oftentimes when we approach it and we try and understand it, we try and understand it and approach it from that that standpoint. And that sometimes gets in our way. So what I kind of want to do today is I'm going to look at this from two different aspects, because I think there are two different ways you have to look at right action and ethics in general to really understand the history of it and the Buddhist interpretation of it and how it came about. In studying the Four Noble Truths, you'll generally find that there's a place where it gets split into two parts. It gets split into the worldly Four Noble Truths, and it gets split in the world-transcending Four Noble Truths. And one way of thinking of those is basically having to do with worldly ethics, society, and the way that ethics work in the world. And the other side of that is the way that these practices lead to liberation. And those are not the same. And I think a lot of times we end up, because of our Western orientation, confusing those and trying to mix them up in a single batch. And I think that doesn't serve us well a lot of times. So first I'm going to spend a little bit of time looking at the worldly side of the teachings. And I think to do that, it's a good idea if you understand a little bit about the life at the time of the Buddha. It's oftentimes people come in and they do a lot of training and meditation and types of things, and there's not really a good background in this. But from our not only the suttas and the teachings that came down through that path, but if you go back and look at a lot of the archaeological records and historical records from that period of time, what you find out is that the Buddha came from a very somewhat tumultuous period. In some ways, it was not unlike our own period. Up until that period of time in history, a lot of the culture in India had been dominated by groups that had come in from the north and brought in the Vedic traditions and the Vedic religion and the Vedic rituals. About a few generations before the Buddha was born, however, that began to change. And it was a The area in which he lived was fairly rich agriculturally. The monsoons would come through. It brought a lot of very rich soil down from the Himalayas. So it was a place where people could live fairly easily. But it was labor intensive. They had no written language. They didn't have a lot of other things that were more modern. However, just before the Buddha's time, they began to establish trade to the north into the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire by that time had become fairly advanced technologically. They had iron working, they had written language, they had large empires, they had, as a result, they had fairly extensive forms of government. They had a lot of very ideas that were very different than you found in India. But what this did is that by the time of the Buddha, then you started having all these new ideas coming into the culture. The old traditions, the traditions of the old religions, the Vedic religions and so forth, were starting to suffer. The Brahmins were falling out of favor. The ascetic groups were arising to counter their ideas, and there were many, many different. There were, in one of the suttas that the Buddha has, he lists 52 different philosophical groups that were, in addition to the Brahmins that were around him, proposing all sorts of different ideas that were coming down the line. So basically, you had a sort of a similar transition that we saw coming out of the medieval period in Europe for us, in which the landowners there were a noble landowners, sort of the Brahmins and the Kshatriyans, and then there were the people who were the merchants and the trade artisans and so forth, and the people who worked the land, the serfs. And you had a very similar type system. But as ironworking came in and they were able to start plowing the land and so forth, they started to be able to produce large surpluses of food. And what that did is it actually gave rise to the ascetic movement, because now you had the food supply to support large numbers of people who didn't have to work the land. So you started having artisans, you started having a transformation of culture, you started to have merchants who would go into Persia and other places and trade. You had all this turmoil and stuff that started to come up. But what it did is it threw the traditional culture into a certain amount of turmoil. What do you believe? What do you do? So forth. That's part of the reason that you will see a number of sutras, like the Kanti Sutra, for example, where the Buddha goes into the town, and this is often quoted in art, that you'll hear about it, where they ask him, how do we know who to believe? I mean, we get this guy coming, this guy coming, this guy. They're all telling us all these different things, and we can't make up our mind. So the Buddha was trying to give them advice as to how to do that. And so you'll get suttas like that. Those suttas were not so much aimed at liberation and taming the mind and all of the other types of things that he was working with his monks. The Buddha was very much of this newly educated group. And although we have the wonderful story of the Buddha being, the son of the king living in the stone palaces and stuff, that's not really, as far as we can tell, what happened. That story does exist in the suttas, but it's actually it's a conglomerate story that's taken from some of the lives of the previous Buddhas. All of the Buddhas, there are many, many, many Buddhas back before the time of Gautama, and all of them have certain common elements to the story, such as being born in some type of elite, being visited by the various heavenly messengers, attaining enlightenment under some type of tree. It's not always the same type of tree. But the stone palaces and all of those types of things that are in the traditional story would not have existed at the time of the Buddha because of the way the countryside was. But he was, as far as we can tell, he was probably the son of a Kshatriya. Kshatriya was one of the classes of people. They were the soldiers, the governors, and so forth. He was one of the son of one of the heads of one of those clans. And he did, in fact, leave to go and do the types of things that you hear about in the story. It's just not quite as romantic as it is in that story. But one of the things that is happening is that the clan that he lived in, the Shocking Clan, was actually probably a tributary clan of two large empires that had started to come into existence. One was the Kingdom of Kosala, which was to the north, and the other one was Magadha, which was to the south. And so you'll see references in all the suttas to Pasenadi, King Pasenadi, who is the king of the of Kosala, and the Chakan Empire was part of the Kosala. So they were not an independent empire. He was not a king. They were a clan of people related by blood that had probably farmed that area before that point of time. And then, but basically, these two large empires at that time, because they were able at that point to start raising armies again because of the food and the steel and weapons and so forth, had started to consolidate the two country into large kingdoms. So Kosala controlled much of the north, and Magadha controlled much of the south. And the Buddha has a number of exchanges with these people. So, and the Buddha then stays within the urban centers. When you look at the places where he had retreats, where he worked and so forth, he stayed within the urban centers. He could have gone out into the forests and so forth, but he actually designed his sanghas to stay with those. That's one of the reasons that the monks are really dependent on the urban centers in order to get food, in order to get clothing and so forth. They go on alms rounds. That's not possible if they're living out in the forest someplace. So he was very much committed to staying within his society, trying to make a society that was equitable, just, harmonious. And so you find a lot of these teachings of right action and so forth that are the worldly right teachings. They're aimed at these populations of people that are not his monks to try and help them resolve this whole crisis of culture that's coming about, this whole transformation. He's trying to help them understand how to put together a society that works, that can get along, that isn't out killing. So in that sense, and in that way, then these commandments of trying not to kill, trying not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, these are in fact aimed at trying to create that type of structure. One of the suttas that he deals with is the Sinulavada Sutta. And the Siddhalavata Sutta, it kind of exemplifies this. One day he was out walking on his alms round, and he comes across this young man who's out there more or less following the old tradition of doing prostrations and offerings to the four directions, north, south, east, west, up, and then the direction of up and down. Because in the older tradition, this is what you did to get blessings and to do so forth. And his father had been very much in this. So he was trying to honor his father's wishes in doing that. And the Buddha saw this young man, and he asks him what he's doing. And the young man explains. So the Buddha then goes through and explains to him how this takes place in in his point of view. And to do this, the Buddha first describes the 14 evil ways that should be avoided by a householder. And here it's important that this is householder. This is not a monk. This is just members of the culture. And the Buddha enumerates these evil ways to be avoided as the four defilements of action: taking life, stealing, misconduct, and lying. So again, the actions that we're seeing taking place in the right action. The four causes of evil action: desire, hatred, ignorance, and fear. So those are things that should be avoided. And the six ways to be avoided of squandering wealth: indulging intoxicants, wandering the streets at inappropriate times, frequenting public spectacles, compulsive gambling, companionship with unworthy people, and habitual idleness. So those are not things that you're going to normally see him telling the monks to do. Okay, these are things that were designed, again, to try and help his culture, his people, his population in general, to reach this type of harmonious thing. Okay, but these are not necessarily acts that are designed, again, to remove defilements from the mind and do this. But you do see these throughout the teachings, that these types of things are there. And then he goes on to explain the importance of having good friends and how good friends, and this ties back to spiritual friends, how this in lay society is an extremely important thing. And then he goes back and tries to tie it into the teachings, the older teachings. And so in order to do that, he redefines the karma's directions as the East being the parents, the South being the teachers, the West being the wife and family, the North being the friends and colleagues, and the two vertical directions as ascetics and Brahmins being the up direction, and the servants who work for you being the lower direction. These are the things that you have to come into harmonious relationship with. These are the things you have to learn to work with and respect and create peace with if you want to live in a culture that is peaceful and harmonious and so forth. So you have this type of teaching that's going on. And as I say, it's kind of designed for the lay people to get a feeling for things. When we encounter this and we don't recognize that this was not liberation, we sometimes get a little confused in our own practice of what's going on. I don't know if any of you have encountered the teachings of the Brahma Viharas. I suspect a lot of you have. One of the concepts that's in there that gets expressed in there are things called near and far enemies. And I assume a number of you know what those are. But for those of you who don't, a near enemy is something that mimics what you're trying to do and what you're trying to create and what you're trying to work with, but it's not. And it undermines you if you try and pursue it. And a far enemy is the opposite. So, for example, if you think about compassion, which is one of the Brahmaharas, the near enemy is pity, and the far enemy is cruelty. Compassion acknowledges a painful experience for what it is. It shares, it creates as equal. Pity, on the other hand, has a tendency of pushing away. It says, you know, in some sense it's saying, I'm better, I don't want to be there, this makes me uncomfortable, I feel sorry for that person. So by doing that, you create a disconnect that moves you away from compassion rather than closer to it. But it's very easy, if you're not careful, to mistake pity for compassion in practice. And so it becomes a great risk. And in some sense, there's something similar that goes on between the worldly right actions and the other right action, in that we start to think that these are things we have to do. That it is the action of non-killing and that is the most important part when you're dealing with the practice of right action of non-killing in the area of liberation. One of the ways that this often manifests is that I've seen in some of the people that I've worked with and in myself is you can make the mistake that, for example, the lack of disagreement, the lack of anger, the lack of problems in a relationship or something that's going on is a sign that you are achieving right action. Okay? Because there's harmony, because there's no disagreement, because none of this stuff is arising, you must be doing things right. But it may well be that it's like the relationship of pity and compassion, that all you've done really is kind of push the whole thing to the side. You've avoided it. And if you've done that, you really haven't started to achieve what you need to achieve in liberation. It's not that the lack of disharmony is bad, just it's not bad that you are not killing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you've achieved what we're trying to achieve on the path. So anyway, this is the one aspect of right action that I think you kind of need to have to understand. So, what I think I'll do is it's about time for us to do a kind of a breakout, and we'll go somewhat in this direction. So we're going to split up into small groups as we usually do, and probably groups, I don't know, how many people are there here today? About 17. So if we break up into groups, there's three or four, I think that would work. It really, there's no advantage for what I'm going to do to you for three or four, so it's okay. So what we'll do then is I'm going to have you just go ahead and we'll rearrange ourselves into groups of three or four. And what I'm going to do is, I don't know if you've done anything what's called popcorn style, but basically what that is instead of having to sit and talk for 2 or 3 minutes, although we'll do that probably in the second breakout, you're only going to come up with one idea, one statement, one quick thing, and then go to the next person. They'll say something, then it'll come to the next person, and it will keep going around like that for the duration. You'll still get about 3 minutes per person for talking, but the idea here is that you're going to use up the quick and easy answers to the question I'm going to use you. So each time you're going around, you're having to reach a little bit deeper. You're also hearing what other people are saying, so it's giving you ideas as you go, and it's just a way of exploring a concept deeper and deeper and pulling yourself down into it. Now, what you say doesn't have to be understood. You're really talking to yourself, and so is everybody else. Obviously, it's useful if you can give other people in the group ideas on this topic, so as we're going around, because it helps them think about things they had never thought of before and directions they hadn't either. So why don't we go ahead and split up? And I'm not going to tell you how to split up, but what I would like you to do is I want to mix it up. So in choosing who you are going to sit with, try and choose the people you know the least. So, you know, just pick somebody you don't know in the room and go join them. And then if as people get into twos, we can have threes and a couple of fours and choose whoever you join based on the fact that you don't know them rather than that you do. Okay? So why don't you just rearrange yourself that way, and then I'll come back around and we'll go forward from there.
Okay. Are you going to be giving us a handout?
No, I'm going to be giving you a little bit more instructions here as soon as people have settled themselves down. And threes and fours are all fine.
Said non-harming him. I almost harmed him. I wasn't done, actually. Yeah, I was supposed to pay attention as I was taking off my sweater.
Okay, so when we talk about refraining from harm, which is what ethics really is about at the bottom, whether you're talking about non-killing, not stealing, whatever, you're at the bottom of it, we're looking at whether we're doing harm to ourselves and others. Our thoughts almost immediately go to, are we harming somebody else, or are we harming an animal, or are we harming some other being, okay? We're less likely to look at what we're doing to ourselves in that trade-off. Philip Moffat is one teacher who talks about the importance of bringing ourselves into focus in this practice as well. And what he says about this is, whenever I introduce the topic of violence against the self in a Dharma talk, almost everyone squirms. No one wants to hear about it. I will directly ask the question, are you in an obvious manner or in a series of subtle and covert actions being violent with yourself? Usually people want to assure me that though they may work too hard at times, stay in an unhealthy relationship, eat too much, or sleep too little, they would not characterize their behavior as being violent towards themselves. Yet person after person, once they closely examine their lives and experience a moment of self-recognition that at first can be painful and embarrassing, this initial discomfort is often followed by a sense of liberation as new possibilities arise. One of these discoveries is the degree to which we make life difficult for ourselves by violating the body and mind in the routine of our daily life. Through ways in which we schedule our time, push our bodies, and care and judge ourselves, we repeatedly create an environment that is filled with violence. If you understand this is so, it may have a profound effect on your experience of life being difficult. So I have two questions that I'm going to do. They're kind of opposites of each other. I'll give them both to you, and then what we're going to do is we'll do the first one for about 5 minutes, and then we'll do the second one. And like I say, what you'll do is you'll just come up with one sentence, then the next person, and so forth. Don't rush it. Give your time to self to think in a unique space to think. They'll wait. Everybody will wait for you until you come up with yours. And then, like I said, we'll just do this for about 5 minutes. Then I'll ring a bell, and we'll go to the second. I'll read the second sentence again, and you can go to it. And they're opposites of each other. So the first one is, when I am engaged with others, I recognize I am acting with integrity when I dot, dot, dot. You know, how do you know that you are acting in right action with other people? What keys you in? What tells you? What comes up in your mind? What comes in your body? What comes up in your experience? Then the second one was that we're going to go the other way, which has to do with the concept of doing violence to ourselves. When I am engaged with others and I recognize I am not acting with integrity, when what comes up, what happens? Okay? So we'll do the 5 minutes on the first question. When I am engaged with others, I recognize I'm acting with integrity when, and I will let you do that for 5 minutes and let you know. So go ahead. Just do the first inquiry. How do you know if you're acting with right? And just one sentence, and then go clockwise around the circle, and just keep going. So pick one person and just say something. Okay. I'll let you wind down. I don't want to rush you right out, so if you have things you need to finish saying, do that. And then we'll come back to a group, and we can see how that was as a group, and see if there was any questions either about stuff I said today, or right speech to this point, or that. And then we'll take a break, go to the bathroom, do all that, and I'll talk about the other side of right action, which is right action as practice for liberation. So how was that? Does anybody have anything they want to tell me about it? So, you know, I'm always interested in how it goes too, and I'm not out there with you, so. Or if you have any questions about anything, that would be fine too. We've got a few minutes here. Leslie's here with her wisdom to help you too. Yeah.
What's your name?
Yeah.
Gary. Gary brought up a good point about he's like, well, I would like to know what everybody's definition of integrity is, because it's not the same for everybody.
True.
Just kind of to start there, but yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I for me, it was in my mind, I'm thinking of experiences in situations with other people. But then there's also situations with yourself, like maybe there's compulsion or control issue or whatever it is around myself. So there's just a lot of...
It's meant to be a little open-ended, because it's meant to give you something to probe, to look deep, to explore with.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't want to pin it down, nor do I really want to pin down what integrity is, although, you know, right action is closely... tied to our definition of integrity.
And I think that the process of self-inquiry is valuable in and of itself, because it's a process. It's not a fixed definition. And at least in my personal experience, and I'd really frame it that way, integrity is in part an embodied experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't necessarily put words to it, but I can feel it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, and I don't want to get started doing another teaching gig here, but I remember that integrated alignment feels more comfortable in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if
yeah.
I have this embodied sense mm-hmm. of when my actions and my sense of goodness line up. Oh, it's like with a different posture. I may think it's easy to slouch, but I don't end up feeling very good after a while. Especially not at my age.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this was in the prompt or not, but in our group, much of what we talked about in terms of action, right action, or actions, whether it's integrity or not, were speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did talk a little bit about just that integration between those.
Oh.
That's, and it's so much in our lives, so many actions in our lives are either speech themselves or related or connected to
yes.
speech. Just an observation.
Yeah, I think speech is probably the easiest area for most people to get into this whole subject area, because it is so much. We're social animal. I mean, so much of our world, so much of everything we do is dependent on speech and communication and language, and that's really what sets us apart in many ways, is that fact that we have to integrate. And, you know, speech is what built our entire culture, ability to pass it from generation to generation, everything. So it's so much of what it means to be human, to have human ethics, to do all that is speech. And it's so easy both to take it in a very negative way and a very positive way. So, yeah, it's the easiest to go into, definitely.
I also think it's really rich to find those connections and those liminal spaces that connect up these different steps on a path. They're not absolutely distinct any more than a flowing river
mm-hmm.
has distinct sections. And so our experience brings them together, sometimes that in really, really rich and important ways.
Yeah.
Because we've talked in our mentoring, our view forms and informs our intentions, which relate to our speech and our actions. And, ooh, all of a sudden, I'm in the river, in the flow.
Yeah.
Anyone else that have a comment or a question? Yeah.
Well, you know, kind of going back to the
whole idea of viewing perspective and experience is that what kind of came up sort of in a summary in our group is that sometimes our actions are deep. And I know this whole process is getting us to, you know, identify all of these different pieces of animals, but so much of that acting, what we do to act with integrity or not act with integrity, goes back a really, really, really long way. Like, pretty young.
Actually, I'd say it probably goes back for that. I think it's in our biology. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you talk about harming, you talk about even things like stealing and so forth, it goes back to the need for resources to live, to raise your young, to do everything else. It goes evolutionary back to the beginning of life, I think. And so that's what we're dealing with. And then, you know, it comes manifest in this lifetime for us, definitely. But this is not a small thing.
And I think it's worth bowing to when we recognize the habit strength that is at the root of so many of our actions. And don't beat ourselves up about that, but just like, wow. Sometimes I'm kind of on autopilot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how's that working for me? How does it feel? Yeah. And remembering, neuroscience geek, we can form new brain pathways, new grooves. And so we both watch what this automatic pilot process may be like and be aware of it and hold some compassion with ourselves about it. And we can set an intention to see what can be done to learn a new pathway. Mm-hmm. And you're here doing that.
Anyone else would like to make a comment or yeah?
I just wanted to thank you for framing it in terms of integrity, because when I think of harm and I think of the big things, you know, like I'm not going around killing people, you know, so the integrity for me just felt a lot more nuanced, and that exercise was really helpful for me.
Good. Thank you. Yes, it's key to right action is that it have a sense of integrity to it. And that for me, that's how I know in many cases or have a feel that I'm engaging in right action is that it feels integral. It feels a part of my whole self. It's a whole. And to me, that's, you know, we're looking for a definition of integrity, but that holistic view of myself is part of what tells me that I'm acting with integrity.
You were going to say something, dear?
Yeah, I feel like acting with integrity for me seems to require some kind of faith or trust in something other than greater than just my narrow self-definition of, because what my ego wants most of the time is not necessarily what the action might be, integrity at a certain time.
Oh, that wonderful and challenging sense of interbeing and interdependence. Everything I do and say is going to resonate in this web, and I have to think about that bigger picture. Yeah, that's big, isn't it? Yeah. And goes beyond it and takes into account and offers the opportunity to go beyond that biology. And to remember that our biology is also about our tribe and our bonding. Yeah. Think of what we do for the little ones we care for, whether they're babies or pets or whatever. Our biology tells us sacrifice everything and care for this little critter, you know. Yeah.
Anyone else? Okay, well, let's take about 10 minutes or so. That gives you a chance to stretch your legs, go to the bathroom, do whatever you would like to do, and then we can come back for the second part.
And I will be leaving a little early today. My apologies for that, but I have some wise action, some kind action needed for a neighbor and her pets.
Okay, so now we can come back for the second part of this, and this time I want to start turning my attention away from the right action as being, in some sense, commandments, things you should do, such as not killing, such as doing this, and start to look at them as practices. And in doing this, I want to kind of acknowledge that when you get these types of right actions that are so strongly stated, such as not killing any living beings, that you can, when you first start working with them, there can be some real sticking points there. Because in the original Pali, what it actually says is that you're not going to harm any living or not any being that breathes. And for us, that's obviously difficult. You know, in some places in India still today, you have some non-honest Buddhist sects, such as the Jains, that take that to an extreme level. A number of them will actually carry a broom along and sweep the sidewalks in front of them as they walk along, just to ensure that they don't actually accidentally step on something. And of course, in our own traditions of the Buddhist traditions, there's a number of lineages, not all of them, but a number of lineages of Buddhists that cannot do things like do any type of farming or tilling soil or anything like that out of fear that in that process they could accidentally cut through an earthworm or something else and harm or damage it. And for us, you know, when we do it, we even have a worse, we in some ways have more problem than, say, a monastic who at least has a way of going into a monastery, getting his food from the outside, and doesn't have to worry about those things at some level. But, you know, we still face the things of, for example, what is the morality of mosquito abatement? You know, you're weighing an issue there of what is the morality of doing something that's going to kill a mosquito carrying malaria versus the risk of giving malaria to a child and, you know, the effect that that has on it. So at some level, there's this feeling of, can you really actually practice these types of things? Or are these just some type of aspiration you put out there as a goal? And no matter what you do, you're probably never going to get there. And I think that the problem in doing that is the one that I alluded back to at the start of this, is that these teachings are really done on two different levels in two different ways, and they're kind of mixed in through all the suttas, where you have the suttas that were, as I was saying, intended for merchants in a city or homeowners in a city, and then you have the teachings that were intended for the monks who were living in the monasteries and so forth. And you can't take all of them at the same level as necessarily meaning the same thing, and that's where your problem starts to arise. But we're trying to sort of be something of both. And so it as soon as you start trying to practice this, as soon as you start trying to work with it, you're going to run into these problems. And I don't want to, you know, play down that these the ethical issues of things like not killing and stuff, they are certainly important, and they're like I say, they're kind of important in the way that I was talking about in the first half, which is in the social, what do you want your society to be like? What do you want your lives to be like? What do you want your relationship with your family and friends and so forth to be like? In that area, your integrity and the values you stand for and the values you stand up in society for are paramount. But when it comes to liberation, that's not necessarily true. That's in some ways not the point. Those are kind of what would be called descriptive ways of looking things. Gil Fronsdahl, in some of his talks, has pointed out that in addition to this descriptive view of right speech and right action and so forth, they can also be seen as prescriptive, as something that is a method for us to move from suffering, from a life of that's kind of governed by our habits, that's governed by our impulses, that kind of just reacts. You know, the driver comes down the road, makes me angry, I flip him off. You know, there's no thought there. It's just, this is the way it is. But, or I can, you know, take a loving kindness view, or I can take a view of where I'm aware of what's happening, decide not to do that. But there is this transition that has to be made if you're going to try and make that. And the teachings of the Eightfold Path were intended to help people make that transition. And in that way of viewing it, it's not so much whether you are successful at never killing anything or at never stealing anything, than that you do, in fact, use them to start to become aware of these habitual patterns, of when these things are arising in you, of being able to start to see what, in fact, is taking place when this type of thing starts to happen in you, and use them as a mechanism for improving on that. And so you can't just, you know, berate yourself for never killing anything, and there's, you know, or come down on yourself, judge yourself that's not the case, because that's not the point necessarily of these things in that in the context that we're talking about now, and in the context that's important to you. When you look at the right action in that context, whereas before, and in I think some of your reading, they're translated as, you know, I will not kill, I will not steal, I will not do that. You can look at the precepts. I don't know how many of you have taken the precepts, but oftentimes when someone comes into the Buddhist tradition, the two ways they acknowledge that they've decided to make that transition to become Buddhist is first to take refuge in the Sangha, the Dharma, and the Buddha. Recognize that that's the place you're going to go forward. And the second way is to take the precepts. And there's usually five precepts that you take. Now, when monks and so forth take those precepts, the translation for the precepts that correspond to what we're doing in right action are phrased a little bit differently. They're typically phrased as, I undertake the training to refrain from destroying living creatures. I undertake the training to refrain from taking what is not given, and I undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct. The point being here is, you're not saying that you're perfect and you're never going to do any of these things. what you're saying is you recognize that they are a tool and that you are committed to this process of using these tools to begin to make this transition away from the habitual and into what is wiser action. In some of her talks on wise action by Andrea Fella, and if you haven't heard those, if you get a chance, she on Audio Dharma, she has some talks on wise on Eightfold Path. She's not normally in the talks that people talk about here, but if you go to Audio Dharma and search for them, she likes to use wise rather than right. So if you go there under her, you probably should search for wise action and wise speech and so forth. I like her stuff because she tends to take it more from this perspective and more from a perspective that helps me understand it in my own life. But what she points out is that the Eightfold Path taken this way is a support for our being in the world. It helps us to let go of those places where we are caught by habitual patterns that block our happiness. Because these patterns are habitual, they do not leave us with much freedom. They are well-worn grooves that run on a kind of autopilot. If our reactions are not working well for us, they just keep bringing us back to the same uncomfortable outcomes over and over. Breaking these patterns is hard, and the first step is just to become aware of them, to know that they take place and what is actually happening. Until we can do that, we do not have enough information to do anything else about them. And that's one of the reasons I keep encouraging people to explore their feelings and what's happening when in all these different exercises and what's coming up. And I've said, it's really good if you can put a certain amount of your attention on what's happening in yourself and maybe some more attention on what's happening in the other person, because it's that awareness that you're trying to practice to take out into the real world to start doing this stuff. Obviously, as I talked in the earlier sutta, the Buddha, when he wants to make these commandments, in a sense, or suggestions as to what would work well in society, he has a lot of other suggestions. He has, don't go gambling your money away because it's going to hurt your family. Don't go taking intoxicating drinks every night because you're going to get yourself in trouble and so forth. In the case of right action in the Eightfold Path, he's really only picked three: non-killing, non-stealing, and avoiding sexual misconduct. Those are good things for society, but I think the reason he kind of narrowed them down is because those three are also related to the three poisons that we are trying to deal with. And so those three actions, when you focus internally at what's happening, you're dealing with it. If you take the concept of not killing, not harming in that sense, it's kind of closely tied to aversion. It's hard to intentionally kill something and not have some type of aversion there. It's obviously possible to kill and not have any intention to it. You, as I've said, the chains walk along sweeping the sidewalk. There's still the possibility they could step on something. And in the Buddhist karmic concept, there is no consequence to that. I mean, it's maybe unfortunate that someone is killed, and you certainly want to avoid it for social reasons and all sorts of other things. But from the standpoint that we're talking about now of liberating the mind, if there is no intention of something happening, there is no karmic consequence to it. Because it's just an accident. It's an unfortunate accident, but it's an accident. On the other hand, if there is an intention to do something like this, then you're probably giving rise to those factors in the mind that you want to deal with. And my wife's probably not going to be happy with me. I told her I'd talk about this subject. But I think it's relevant here. I live in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and with the latest set of rains that have been coming in, we've started to deal with lots and lots of ants. I don't know how many of you have that problem. Now, I like living in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I grew up in the primitive areas of Idaho when I was a child. I really like the outdoors. I have a great relationship with the critters around me. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed in this latest set of things, when they come in, that my reactions, my relationships to those ants are very situationally dependent. You know, if they come down my chimney, walk across in front of my fireplace and go back up my chimney, I probably say, okay, they'll be gone. And as soon as the weather here starts disappearing and drying out, and that's probably going to be fine. When they start climbing across my kitchen counter and into my dishwasher or going after my cat's food, I have a very different attitude towards them. If I look at myself at that moment, I can tell the reason I have a very different attitude is my level of aversion is much higher. I don't want them in my cat's food. I don't want them on the kitchen. I don't, you know, that's my food. You stay away from it. And so there are times I will turn on the dishwasher and I will kill ants. But at least in that process, I am aware of what I'm doing and I'm aware of what's arising in me. And I can make that decision. In some cases, you know, there have been some cases where I don't want the ants there, but I can sit down with myself and say, is there really a harm here? If I just go away into my office and do a work and do other stuff in a few hours, I'll come back, they'll be gone. Or maybe I should put a little bit of vinegar or something here by the door to discourage their chemical trail so that they don't come in and they'll find someplace else to go and I'll go away. And I can do that because I recognize what's happening in my mind and I can work with it. But there are, like I say, other cases where they're after my cat's food and I know my cat's not going to eat it anymore and all that, and I have no practical way of doing anything without it, that, yeah, I'm going to break the right action. But I don't, in this case, again, this is practice, this is training. I've undertaken the training not to kill living beings. That doesn't mean that I don't. And this is true of all of these various precepts and so forth. These things are here to train us, to help us. And this type of practice is forever practice. You're going to be doing it. I've been doing this practice for a lot of years. I'm not done. But it's still relevant, it's still there, it's still a powerful experience to see how these various things can fit into your life and really be important to what's going on. So it's this process of becoming aware of what's arising and looking closely at it and seeing what it is, and because you see what it is, you can make decisions about what's going to happen. And when you do that, you start to change the way you behave and the way you are in the world. And as you do that, there's less suffering for you and there's less suffering for everyone around you, hopefully even for the ants. This process works both in the negative and the positive. I was talking to someone earlier this week about compassion practice and other things within this whole same similar context. A lot of times, you know, you have meta practice, which I think is a wonderful practice. It's a powerful practice. It does help to raise a level of meta, and it does help. It's a great concentration practice above everything. But the question becomes, do you need necessarily to focus on things like, in this context, on focus on things like compassion? Are these two different projects, not killing and having compassion for the creatures you're not killing? And the answer is no, they're not. At least not in my experience, they aren't. What happens for me is as I can suppress this aversion, as it, I am less likely to kill it, I'm more likely to become interested in it, I'm more likely to accept it into my environment, I'm more likely to let it go across, down the chimney across, and back up the chimney and say, that's fine. And as I do that, the space that was formerly taken up by this aversion starts to fill up with kindness and compassion. It's not like I have to go out and practice compassion for the ants. It's like when I become less averse to the ants, I naturally, that compassion, that understanding, that acceptance of other forms of life in my world improve. And there are, as I said, there are other things that are easier. When I had foxes come into my backyard and build a den and have their cubs, it was really easy to be compassionate for them and turn my backyard over to them so that when they came out to play, I stayed inside and watched them through my window because I didn't want to disrupt the parenting process of those. So there are some things like that that it's very easy. Because I had no aversion for them, it was easy for me to be compassionate. For places where there is more aversion, it's much harder for me to be compassionate. But I realize that if I can deal with this aversion, I start to solve the problem of compassion. And that, then, is what runs through all three of these. As you start to deal with the problem of greed, of wanting, of taking, which is tied to the not stealing element of right action, then you start to find that generosity is something that can start to come up and start to fill that void and be there as something that you experience. Similarly, as you start to deal with the delusion that can come from sexual misconduct. And sexual misconduct here, taken in the Indian tradition, had more to do with fidelity and adultery and this type of thing. In our modern culture, there's many things that we label as sexual misconduct. Some of them are greed, some of them are aversion. I mean, it runs the gamut. But within this context, I think these three things are more closely tied to aversion, greed, and delusion, that somehow you can have something that can't really exist through behavior that lacked fidelity. And that's why the teachings teach that in dealing with sexual misconduct, it is fidelity and it is loyalty and companionship and those types of things that will come in and fill its place. So as you deal with the negative and you drive it out and you it's not a forceful driving out, but it's a recognizing of what it is when it's happening and being able to see it long enough to make a choice an intelligent choice. I don't want to do this. I don't want to kill those ants because they're not doing me any harm. You know, when you can do that, that's the point then at which this other quality can start to come in. That's not saying that meta practice isn't good practice, but it's saying that it will come in as a natural part of this process, as a natural part of practice. And practice in this area is not judged by, did I ever kill an ant or did I ever do this? It's judged by, am I aware of what I am doing and am I learning to accept and deal with it in a way that is through freedom, through being able to make intelligent choices, choices of non-harming, choices of my own happiness, the happiness of others, my benefit, the benefit of others. If I'm able to do those things, all of these things will, in fact, come together of their own. Okay, so that's the other side of it then.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
So, you know, not being a monk or a Buddha myself, is there ever a time when you can kill something and be, you know, I mean, it's like I have rats sometimes come around my house, you know, and then those rats
It depends. I'll answer this the way the Buddha did sometimes, which was there's no one answer to that. And the reason I said, and it's sort of the reason I structured this class the way I did today, if you're asking me, is there a reason that you can kill a rat from the first talk I gave today, which is the worldly view, then yes, as I said, you make an informed decision as to whether you do mosquito abatement to kill malaria-carrying diseases based on are there children living nearby that are likely to get malaria and suffer their life for it. And I think there are legitimate reasons for doing that. Okay? That's a social, that's a worldly answer to that question. If I take it from the other standpoint, the standpoint I'm talking about now, which is the idea of liberation and driving and learning to drive aversion from my mind and learning to live a compassionate world and so forth, then I guess the answer is no. Because that killing, even though I can justify it, is going to have impact back on my mind. When I make the decision to turn on the dishwasher to clean my dishes, because there's no way I can get every animal out of my dishwasher without doing that, and there's no way I can get my dishwasher's dishes clean again, I feel it. I know it. You know, it has an impact on me. I still do it. But I can't escape the fact that I am killing something. So from that standpoint, no, there's no possible way you can do it. That's why I tried to structure this today, that there are two sides to this. It's not a simple, one-sided question. Yeah?
There aren't owl boxes and owls will eat the rats.
True, true.
You should introduce them.
Yeah, and that goes back to the first part. Socially, what do you do? I mean, do you take criminals and execute them if they're murderers, or do you put them in jail without the possibility to parole? That's a social decision, and those types of justifications and judgments and so forth are social, worldly justifications and judgments, and they're valid. They're absolutely valid. But they have no impact on this process of practice for liberation. That is still has an impact if you kill. Yeah.
Quick question. You were talking about the sort of non-forceful driving out of the three poisons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Diversion, greed, delusion.
Mm-hmm.
With less greed, you opened up space for, what did you say?
Generosity.
Generosity. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
And with delusion, you're opening up space for, you said fidelity?
Fidelity,
can
yeah.
Explain?
No, fidelity and, well, the reason I said fidelity is because that is in relationship to sexual misconduct. It also opens up the area for mindfulness and for honesty in what's present. Fidelity, I think, goes back more to the sexual misconduct thing. Oftentimes, in relationships that are where there's sexual misconduct in the sense of adultery and stuff, there is this belief that somehow it can take place without doing harm, without hurting other people, without hurting oneself, without having an impact on society, without all of these things taking place. That, in general, at least in my opinion, is a delusion. And what it does is it poisons the relationship with the other person, because now it's no longer an honest relationship with that person. It's no longer an honest relationship between that person and other people. And so it's the delusion that this is even a possible thing to carry out and make work that is poisoning the mind in that specific context. But beyond that, it destroys honesty. It you know, if you can get rid of delusion, you can more honestly interact in the world and see what's taking place here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And what's real.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, let's do another quick breakout session then. This time we'll let you do a little bit of talking with each other. So why don't you go ahead and you can go back to groups of three or four. And you can either rejoin the same people you were with if you want. That would be fine. Makes it easy. If they're all still here. If not, rearrange yourself. I know some people had to go because they're on call for medical reasons and things like that. So if you need to rearrange, groups of three and fours are fine. Okay, so this time we'll go back to the old format. We're going to go ahead and do rotating, and so each of you will have about 3 minutes to talk. Let's see, why don't we take the person with the fewest number of colors on as the person in each group that starts? If there's two of you with the same number of colors, I'll let you guys fight it out. Okay, so this goes back to the question of how you practice anyway, what we're trying to do. So I want you to think back to see if you can remember a real-life instance when you were engaged with someone else and realized that part of your practice, either metta, right speech, renunciation, whatever, would be a skillful thing to adopt. You know, you're doing something, like I was seeing the ants and I become aware of my aversion, and it's a useful thing to have in practice here. Okay, what helps you to make that realization, to trigger it? So that's one question. I'm going to give you two questions, and that way you can pick the one that works best for you, and I don't tie you into one. I want you to, it's very similar, but rather than practice, it has to do with mindfulness. Okay, when you're engaged in a situation and you come back to mindfulness, you come back to being aware of what's taking place, rather than caught up in a habit or an automatic reaction, what is it that you do or have done in the past or anything like that you find helpful to allowing you or helping you learn to make that transition? And I know that sometimes those two transitions to a practice like metta or to a practice like mindfulness are almost magical. You're not quite sure why you do it. Mm-hmm. But grab as best you can for what it is, and I'll give each of you 3 minutes to talk about what does it. Yeah?
Can you do the first one more time?
Sure. Let's see where they put it. I can figure out where I put it. There we go. Think back to see if you can remember a real-life instance when you were engaged with someone else and realized that part of your normal practice, such as metta or right speech or renunciation, is a skillful thing to be doing at that moment. Like you're in an argument and whatever, you decide that you need metta right now, okay? What, in that instance that you're remembering, was it that helped to trigger you to realize that metta would be useful at that point? And like I say, it's somewhat magical. You may not be able to define it, but do the best you can. We're just exploring to figure out what's going on. Okay? So why don't the first person go ahead and talk? Or do you want a couple minutes here to think about it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go 3 minutes. I'll give you each 3 minutes. We're just going to sit quietly. You can think about it, and then I'll let you know when the person goes. So when it's convenient, we'll come back together and share comments as a full group. So how was that for everybody?
Interesting. Yeah. Surprised what came up.
So why don't we come back and then we can hear each other and... I'm interested in what your reaction was, and I'm sure there are other people that are, and we've got about another 10 minutes we can use here to explore before we're finished. So if there's questions, we can do those too. So are there any comments about the experience? Or what you learned or didn't learn? Yeah.
I found it really hard to think of a scenario, so I think that's a lesson right there.
Is it because you don't find yourself suddenly waking up in the middle of a thing, or because you just don't remember?
Maybe I just, yeah, we'll do that.
Okay, sounds good. I have that problem too. Yeah.
Yeah, if some encounters are just really, really, really super hard,
mm-hmm.
The mindfulness does not come in for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I learned. Mm-hmm.
That's why it's called gradual training. I mean, and that's why it takes a lifetime. I mean, I've been meditating for close to 50 years now, and I'm still learning. You know, as I said with my thing here, I'm doing a lot of work lately with aversion, and it takes me sometimes a lot to realize that that's what I'm doing. And sometimes it's not then. Sometimes I'll go work on a talk or whatever else, and I say, you know, that's what I did. You know, I'm aware now of what was going on. Mm-hmm. I can't go back and change it, but at least there was a point where I did become aware. So it's gradual. It takes time, and it's never complete. So I understand. Yeah.
Something that kind of indication of not being aware of how I'm communicating,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes my facial expression or body language is conveying something, and as I get when I'm getting feedback from another person, then I'm like, oh, I'm not communicating what I intend to be communicating, and I have to go into this clear up thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem of intention, because a lot of times the confusion that happens between people is that you don't really know what their intention was, and so you come to your own conclusion. I know what they intend, which is not what they intend, and you react to that, and they don't understand. But that's why we try desperately to get back to this thing of mindfulness, of trying to react not to all those triggers and all those habits and everything else, because a lot of times our intentions arise out of those, but rather hopefully come back to being able to be here and saying, I'm confused. I don't know what they're trying to tell me. Will you tell me what you're trying to tell me? You know, things like that. But it's an ongoing process, yes. Thank you. Yeah.
The trigger to mindfulness is our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that does seem magical.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, what an incredible tool that's always been there that
yes.
I completely ignored.
Yes.
And it's really, really remarkable to just not even in tough situations, in other happy situations, you know, this is what it feels like to my body
mm-hmm.
to feel elated or
mm-hmm.
whatever the thing is. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that to me is the magic. That's the magic I'm noticing.
I agree. I think it's an important magic. It took me a long time looking at the Buddhist teachings where it talks about things like mindfulness of the body and all that, why there was so much emphasis on the body, you know, what the body does and all these things, the body scans and everything else. And it really is because there is so much information there. And, you know, if you look from more modern scientific ways of looking things, emotion is a body sensation. It's not a mental sensation. We may interpret it in our minds, you know, I'm feeling happy or I'm feeling angry. But in truth, that emotion is centered in the body. And if you didn't have the body, if you didn't have those muscles, if you didn't have that breathing, you would not be feeling those emotions. They would not exist. So much information is in the body if you can listen to it. I agree.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing about the body, and I think that's what I'm noticing when I do make that connection, you know, of the heart. It's like the heart has its own mind, and this mind up here, this consciousness, that sometimes is right on point, but most of the time not. Sometimes this body says, take a breath. Breathe into your heart, breathe. And then it changes everything. It changes, you know, the way you see it, the way I see everything. It gives me a moment to connect to what's really going on as opposed to what, you know, the mind says is going on.
Well said. Thank you. Is there anyone else that has a comment or a question about anything today or any of that? Yeah.
Well, I appreciated your share about how it's with the harder things, it's like harder to, I don't know if I'm saying that right, but there's some issues that it's harder to not react. And I appreciate what you've been saying about it being a practice
mm-hmm.
rather than an outcome. Because I'm like, yes. It's definitely a lot of things where I'm like, I could see this is not really wise action, but I'm not quite there yet. The actual taking of the wine.
Yeah, that's why it's important to be... that's why yourself is in... We practice for all beings. We practice for ourselves as much as anybody else. That's why it's very important in this practice to be kind to yourself, to be gentle with yourself, and not to judge yourself either. You know, this is practice. It takes time. Being harsh with yourself is of no use either. It will come if you have the commitment to it and you keep coming back to it. It will come, and you'll look back 10 years later and say, you know, I used to. You know, when I was driving that road, or I went in to see my boss, that was the way I was. But I'm different now. I'm doing it. And I don't know how exactly or what exactly I did. That's why I was saying it's kind of magical sometimes as to what pulls you back. But it's nice to think about anyway. But you'll look back and say, yeah, I suddenly realized that all this time I put into here has, in fact, changed me in a way that makes me suffer less, happier, and more satisfied with myself. But there's no magic recipe. It's just a process that unfolds. It's life. It's a way of being in the world. And that's at least why I do it. Yeah.
I think that's important what you said about the time it takes to change. Because I once heard, not directly, but heard that a monk or a Buddhist teacher told his Sangha that you measure how effective your practice has been in decades,
mm-hmm.
right? So you look your first 10 years of practice, you don't look until the 10th year. And
mm-hmm.
and I can say that because that's my own experience. I'm probably in my 10th year of practice now, and I don't notice the little incremental changes that have been. But I look back at who I was 10 years ago. No, I have been doing other things as well, but
mm-hmm.
it's different. And if I go and try to think it's like lifting weights and I got to feel better tomorrow, when I apply that to the mental and other practices we do here, it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to see the benefit in weeks and months in this kind of practice that you would from other kinds of, you know, more
mm-hmm.
active things.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I agree. Very good. Anyone else? Okay, well, thank you for being here today. Leslie will be here next time with Right Livelihood, and I appreciate your attention. I may any beings that are aware of our practice today be happy that it's taking place, and may all beings in all the directions, north, south, east, west, above and below, benefit from what we've done today. May all of them be happy. May all of them be healthy. And may all of them be at peace. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.